I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Be the best and you got to pay a little price. If you want it bad enough, you got to do a little extra things to get it.
Welcome to the 11 Personnel Podcast, your favorite Rams podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Rodriguez, and with me, as always, my fabulous co-host, Rich Hammond. Rich.
How we doing?
Jordan, we got to watch some football the other day. I mean, technically speaking.
Asterisk.
I guess. But football, nonetheless.
One thing that is has been great about the Rams preseason for the last two seasons is, even though it is preseason football, you are guaranteed that Bryce Perkins will make it worth the price of admission, because that dude lights it up in the preseason. His lore and his legend expands.
Yes, Mr. Preseason, as it were, which is not look, if you're a guy who's looking to earn your spot in the league and keep your spot in the league, that's not the worst thing in the world to shine out in the preseason. So, of course, we are talking about Saturday's Rams 29-22 victory over the dreaded neighbors, partners, whatever you want to call them, the Chargers. Great uniform combination, by the way. I need to say that up front.
Sharp on screen.
What a stunning display of two really great uniforms. So that was my big takeaway. That'll be my big contribution to the podcast today. But Jordan, let's just be clear here. We knew going in that this is what this was going to be. We're kind of joking about, oh, backups and Bryce Perkins, all that. This has been the trend for quite a while now, and everybody knew that this is basically what it was going to be. So you know that going in, and you look for people to say, all right, who's going to grab that brass ring? Who's going to shine? You mentioned Bryce Perkins has now done it consistently over the last couple of years. But Jordan, my goodness, we talk, and we're going to say it again at the end of the episode about how you need to subscribe to The Athletic to get all of Jordan's coverage. Jordan was telling you about a young receiver you probably hadn't heard about named Lance McCutcheon way back when, and it showed out just some outstanding catches. I mean, that was my first real opportunity to see him in live action anyway. 60-yard catch and run, great touchdown catch. Jordan, it didn't surprise you, but were you surprised at all to see him show out in that type of environment?
So it didn't surprise me. No, I think it kind of similar to Bryce. This was something that the Rams and, you know, were expecting to be a possibility. And certainly I was expecting Lance to not only get a ton of playing time, but then also make a case for why they should bench him for the rest of the preseason so that they can hide the guy.
Right.
Because there's no way he sits on a practice squad after that outing. I mean, it's not just that it was a great performance from him. He did not look like a rookie, and he did not look like an undrafted free agent. And that's the differentiation between, oh, this guy flashed in the preseason versus, yeah, other teams will want to sign this guy. That was kind of where they were at with Bryce Perkins last year too. That differentiation specifically between, yes, he's great in the preseason, and oh shit, another team might sign this guy if we waive him to bring him back on the practice squad. He could get claimed off waivers, and then obviously would have to be on the active roster somewhere else to do so. The Rams' wealth of receivers and other teams, specifically also some teams that sit very high on the waivers that don't have the wealth of receivers the Rams have, that would be very enticing indeed. So I think that this is a champagne problem. Sean McVay said yesterday, today is Monday morning when we were recording, Sean McVay had a press conference yesterday and said he certainly thinks that Lance McCutcheon has a case for making the 53-man roster. And part of it also is because Lance McCutcheon can play special teams. And that's what I saw during camp that made me think, not just his work in OTAs, which is when I first, I think I tweeted about it. I don't know. It's definitely in an article. It's on Twitter, whatever. Anyway, I was like, okay, so this guy does not move like a rookie. He moved confidently. He has sort of that, and nobody truly, I don't think, really compares to Cooper Kupp, but in terms of that professionalism, specifically, like, not wide-eyed, just very, like, this isn't too much for me to absorb and process, and very this coolness sort of moving through his assignments and his responsibilities. You could really see that. You could tell the difference between guys who are a little rattled by being there versus guys who are like, nope, I'm good with this actually. And Lance McCutcheon is the latter, of course. And then Cooper Kupp shouting him out very subtly in one of his press conferences in the spring. I mean, you pay attention when Cooper calls someone out. Like, you pay attention to who that player is when he name drops someone, especially someone who's an undrafted free agent and who, like Cooper, is from the Big Sky Conference. So I think that this has been an interesting development. Now, again, even people who attended training camp probably didn't see much of Lance because he was usually working with the third team on offensive installs. And that's also okay. That's where they're installing the structures of their offense, to especially for players who don't necessarily have the full, you know, grasp of it yet because they're rookies or they're super new additions to the team, or in a lot of cases their depth. But I think that this was an interesting onboarding for him because he also was playing on special teams too. So all of this becomes a lot more intriguing, not just because of what his clear ability is. And also I have saved a tweet from somebody after I did tweet about Lance in the in OTAs. I have a tweet saved where this person said, oh, he doesn't really do much. He can get open sometimes. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have my phone in front of me, but I have it screenshot where it's like, oh, you know, he's not altogether strong or fast or whatever. He can just kind of get open sometimes and that's all he does, kind of implying that he's like a one trick guy. I was like, well, I just watched him moss somebody. So right. I'm pretty sure that's fine. I'm pretty sure Matthew Stafford's watching that and freaking drooling over on the sideline. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But it is intriguing, and it's more intriguing because, and you never obviously want people to be hurt, but the opportunities will increase in the preseason because Jacob Harris is recovering from a groin injury. Now, a lot of these guys who he maybe would have been competing for snaps for, they are not playing in the preseason because Van Jefferson is dealing with his knee rehab, which I hear is going well right now. So guys like Ben Skronik and Tutu Atwell and Brandon Powell, who are in the not just me hypothesizing, Sean McVay outright now finally coming out and saying a committee of players who could replace the snaps that Van Jefferson would otherwise take,
right.
Which presents its own problems that we've covered in depth in previous episodes. So we're not going to relitigate that. But because Van Jefferson is not currently playing, you also have to be extra careful with some of the other guys who would be in that committee. And then so it further opens up the opportunity for a player like Lance McCutcheon, because not only are you not necessarily directly competing for snaps at this current moment with Jacob Harris, because Jacob Harris is recovering from an injury, but also you have more of a snap share because a Ben Skoranek is not taking preseason snaps. A Tutu Atwell is not taking preseason snaps. A Brandon Powell is not taking preseason snaps. So it's like you and JJ Koski and just a bunch of guys who, you know, have been really solid practice squatters or depth guys for the Rams. And it's his time to shine. And so I think that this is a huge opportunity for him. It's a huge moment for him. It certainly was incredibly impressive. Surprised? No, but very impressive all the same.
Yeah, Jordan, and it's not a case where he was just the best of those guys that you're talking
correct.
About.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a case where you really showed you something independent of who was out there on the field with him or who was throwing the ball or who was whatever. Like, I mean, you could see the skill there. And yeah. That to me is something that's going to translate no matter who's out there with him. Might even be elevated if he, you know, depending on who he's playing with the other personnel out there. So very impressive, and your scouting skills are shining through with.
I'm good for one a year, maybe.
That's better than that's I ever fine. Did. Let's put it that way. I never
one of 53. My hit rate's great.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. That's I would take that and run with it. You know, we want to go through a few. And by the way, if people haven't already seen it, you have a great column up on The Athletic right now that got published on Sunday, I believe, about all about this game and kind of takeaways. But kind of wanted to go a little bit more in depth on a couple of these just because there are some interesting. Oh, by the way, we'll get to the punter, too. I got a couple of tweets during the week. How come you guys haven't been talking about punting? What about special teams? So we'll make sure we talk about the punting situation before we get to the end there. But just keeping it on offense a little bit, Jordan, the one thing that's hard to tell sometimes is some of these offensive line rotations and who is playing exactly how much. But I know we were both kind of keeping an eye on Logan Bress and obviously, you know, a big name, I guess you would say, in terms of the preseason anyway, but a big part of this preseason and how he's going to fit. Is he going to be able to potentially earn a starting job? Is he going to be able to show that he can contribute during a season? So first preseason game, you're not going to put a ton of stock into that for an offensive lineman being out there for the first time. But what was your takeaway from watching him during that game?
Yeah, I thought he got a lot better as the game continued. There was a pretty gnarly moment there in the first quarter where he had sort of his welcome to the NFL scene, I guess you would say, and he'll remember that. And then you could see him putting it together and learning kind of as time went. And I would also say, too, that this is not a line that he played with through the rest of the training camp. Like, he's repping in with the ones and twos. So when you're in live action and then it's a bunch of guys that you have not repped alongside through the entire rest of the year, minus, you know, AJ Jackson, who I also thought played really well, that's also going to be a little bit of an issue. I think you're not going to maybe get a fully clear picture just from us as casual people or studiers of the football. Like, you're not going to maybe get a full representation like the coaching staff, who's looking for specific things from him, will get. You know, he's never going to be lining up next to Bobby Evans. He is never going to be lining up next to Jeremiah Colon. And I think that this is just one of those sort of caveats where you isolate his snaps and look at those things. And and in doing that, I thought he got a lot better as the game went on. And you even saw the coaching staff seeing some good things from him through the end of the first half, pulled him for the third quarter and then sent him back in the fourth, and where I thought he played really well in that fourth quarter. So that was good. I think that there's a lot of promise there for Logan Bress, someone who I thought also sort of solidified his spot, not just on the 53, but on the 46 was Alaric Jackson. And that's interesting because if we're looking at the line as a whole at that point, Coleman Shelton, to me, is in full command of that right guard spot right now. And it's important, too, that you have him because he can play any of the interior spots on the offensive line. And in that regard, you have not just a rostered, and I'm talking about the 46 specifically. So the guys who are active on game day specifically, who get a jersey on game day, and you have to decide how many linemen. You maybe carry 7 to 8 linemen, right? And especially if they're going to carry a shitload of receivers, probably 7, right? Right. 7 linemen. So yeah, it's important that one of your linemen can not only back up your center in a pinch, but also play either guard spot in a pinch. It's important that David Edwards could kick out to tackle in a pinch. It's important that Rob Havenstein's so solid. And then Joe Noteboom is who he is and has been really solid through camp. And, you know, really, I think you can expect some promising things from him as long as he can stay healthy. So having those numbers and then having Coleman Shelton, who's what we call interior swingman, essentially, because he can move from side to side. And then AJ Jackson, who can be a bit of a swingman in a sense, because you saw him kick inside to guard and sort of hold his own pretty well. Right. Some of their better running plays, I think, from that game. And, you know, Sean McVay mentioned a really great point yesterday where it was like, it's really hard to evaluate the run game when you do have someone as dynamic as Bryce. And it wasn't a knock on Bryce, but it was like, you're not really going to run your running game because you know that the quarterback is the biggest threat on the field in the run. So I think, you know, understanding that, but I think some of their stronger plays did come in the run when AJ Jackson was on the field in a variety of positions. And so I think that that's kind of what you're looking at. You're looking at Logan Bress active. You're looking at the 5 that we know active. You're looking at AJ Jackson. You're looking at and I think that's your 46, frankly. And that's kind of simple, right? And yeah, I'm sure it'll complicate 2 weeks from now, because that's the Rams. But it's, you know, it seems like they sort of that's really important to have that sort of solidified this time of year and figured out. And of course, other guys could come in and maybe crack spots. I'm still looking to see what AJ Arcuri can do. You know, I think that, but in terms of maybe your seven that you're looking at, and I'm counting on my fingers just so I'm counting correctly. You're looking at Jonah Boom, David Edwards, Brian Allen, Coleman Shelton at that starting right guard spot, Rob Havenstein, and then you're looking at Logan Bruss, because you have to you drafted him saying he will compete for a starting spot, so you know, right, he's gonna have to do that. Logan Bruss and AJ Jackson, and I think you're pretty confident in that seven. I think that's a pretty solid game day active.
That's right where you want to be, right? I mean, that's the, and as you said, things can change. Things probably will change at some point, but that's a much better position to be in than looking at your group and going, oh boy, who's going to fill these seven spots? Yeah. You know, where you want to be right now is, okay, if the season started tomorrow, you know, we've got our seven. And if something happens over the next 3 weeks here to change that, if somebody, you know, just shows that they have to be on that active roster because they're playing so well and doing so well, that's a great problem to have. That's exactly what you want to have. You don't want to have the problem of, oh boy, we've got these three guys here and we're just going to pick the best one of them because we need somebody. That's not where you want to be. So, you know, excellent news for the Rams' perspective to hear that Joe Noteboom is doing well. Excellent to hear that Coleman Shelton seems to have grabbed a hold of that spot. Encouraging that Logan Bruss seems to be showing that he can handle something. So that's really kind of the best case scenario. I mean, we don't know, frankly, nobody knows what's going to happen when week one comes and these guys get tested for the first time against a, you know, Buffalo pass rush. We don't know, but we're not going to know between now and then. But they seem to put themselves in as good a position as you can get. And Jordan, along those lines, you talked about the run blocking, and I'm curious just to get your thoughts on that running back situation here, because obviously there's Cam Akers, and obviously there's Darrell Henderson, and if those two guys are healthy, which is always the big question, but let's assume that you go into the season with a healthy Cam Akers and a healthy Darrell Henderson. What are we looking at but behind them in terms of numbers? I mean, you just went through the numbers with the offensive linemen, what that could look like. You've got a guy who they drafted in Kyren Williams, who's obviously going to get a good look because of that. You've got Jake Funk, who obviously was there last year and contributed. You've got Raymond Calais. You've got AJ Rose. I mean, how is that? Again, not to put too much of it on one game, of course, but kind of how do you see that shaping out at this point?
So one thing that I thought of it kind of struck me this morning, because I was kind of looking at old clips and just kind of going through what was going on this time last year. And because I have no life, as you know, walk the dog, go through old clips, get ready for practice, drink a gallon of coffee. Yeah. So, you know, hydrate. So I was looking at Darrell Henderson from last year, and obviously he went through like a bit of a dicey training camp, right? Where he was not healthy through training camp. Now that this is a big difference. He is healthy. He's been healthy through training camp. He was working through a bit of a soft tissue injury in the spring, but, and I'm knocking on wood, you can literally hear me doing it.
Yeah.
He has been healthy through training camp and he will not be playing in the preseason. So there is no reason that he will not start the season as healthy as he has ever been, if not healthier, right? So it's kind of at that point a little bit of an unknown. So I think that that's something. And then obviously there was no Cam Akers last year this time either. So they're in a bit of a bind. This year to me, 1-2-3 is, you know, Cam Akers and Darrell Henderson. And I saw them taking pretty even rep share through training camp with the ones, working a lot in the passing game. There's no reason to believe that the Rams won't at least initially start with a bit of a committee approach, as they've done for the past couple of years. And I assume one of those guys will take the lead as time progresses, as we have seen them do in previous years. Previous years, of course, the caveat is they've had to because of injuries in various places. But, you know, I think that then you're looking at the three spot, and I think you're looking at Jake Funk in that three spot. not just because he has a ton more of the experience, but also because of how he is contributing on special teams. And the three and the four at running back probably have to contribute on special teams. And I'll say this too. They love Kyren Williams, love Kyren Williams. They are still, they initially said he would play in probably the third preseason game, or joint practices would be what they're looking at for him, but have since sort of pulled back a little bit and said they're not sure if he actually will, although he is on track and his rehab's going well after that broken foot in the spring. And obviously he's off PUP and he's contributing, and they love Kyren Williams. But I think you're looking at a kind of a big if, like, do you keep four running backs? And I think the health of Cam Akers and the health of Darrell Henderson, the way that you want to use them, and then the people you need elsewhere contributing on special teams, you know, you need to make sure that Kyren Williams and Jake Funk, both, if you're keeping both of them, can contribute on special teams. We know for a fact Jake Funk can.
Right.
And it's not Kyren's fault that we don't know whether he can or not. He just hasn't had the opportunity because he's been hurt. So this is where it's a little complicated, because their numbers are going to shake out a little bit complicated, because they're going to carry extra DBs because they're all so good at such a young age. And they're going to probably carry extra receivers. Like, I could really see this team carrying eight receivers. I'm not kidding. And I think that's wild to say out loud. But then you think about, okay, well, they'll only keep three tight ends, you know, Tyler Higbee, Bryson Hopkins, and Kendall Blanton. And then I think Tyler and Kendall are the one and the two. And then Bryson, I think, has really improved. And, you know, I think that that's a solid tight end group, and you only keep three. So, you know, that gives you an extra number for receiver, but you need two extra numbers for receiver without removing from your DBs, because right, not only do those guys have to play special teams, but they also are all, like, you don't want to cut any of those young guys that you brought in because they're all very good. And so then maybe that means you're looking at a top heavy position that where starters are established, where the last spot is a little bit up for decision. And that those are the kinds of leverages that they're making, and the kinds of sort of checks and balances that they're making this time of year. And so I would think that they would want to keep both Jake Funk and Kyren Williams. I would assume that they would want to keep both of those guys. However, I can't know for sure if they do want to keep four running backs on the active roster when they release their initial 53. So I can't know that for sure. I just know that for sure they would like to keep these young DBs around, and for sure they are not putting any sort of cap on what they're going to be doing at receiver in terms of the numbers, because now, in my opinion, as of now, it's early, obviously, but in my opinion, you do not cut Lance McCutcheon.
Right.
In my opinion, you do not cut Brandon Powell, because Joe DeCamillis was pretty blatantly, you know, honest about how he is not feeling confident in Tutu Atwell's development as a return specialist. And so in that regard, you need a return specialist at that point, which you would obviously, in a perfect world, your number four receiver could do that for you. But in this case, they'll keep an extra, and Brandon Powell can also work into the offense, did some nice things in the slot when he was working with the ones and the twos in training camp. And so you're looking at sort of loaded numbers there and at DB, and those extra DBs can play special teams, and those extra receivers can play special teams. Brandon Powell obviously plays special teams. Lance McCutcheon obviously plays special teams. If you keep Jacob Harris, which I think he'd be very hard to cut because of how much potential he has there, and he just has been hurt, and it's not his fault. He's been hurt. It's just there's so much potential there, and you just moved him over into receiver, understanding that you would be front-loaded at receiver. So to me, this is a real awareness that they have about it. He's very hard to cut because he plays in all four special teams phases, and the explosive athletic potential is there. So that means that you're looking elsewhere, and this is a long way of winding back around and, to your running back question, saying, is that the place where they think, okay, you know, we made it through last year. If we can just keep these guys healthy this year, then already we're doing better than we did last year,
right,
at the position. And so that's kind of where I'm thinking some of the conversations might be in terms of their checks and balances right now.
Yeah, and that's such a huge part of it, right? I mean, it's a huge puzzle piece that you have to put together. It's not always, oh, we want to keep this number of running backs or this number of receivers. It's a zero-sum game. Like, if you want to keep one of those young receivers, then what are you going to get rid of? Are you not going to keep another linebacker? Are you not going to keep another defensive back? So that's kind of the puzzle piece or the puzzle that has to be put together this time of year. And Jordan, you mentioned specifically the DBs, which is the other area that I wanted to get into, because again, we're seeing some of these younger guys, they're getting an opportunity and they're also taking advantage of it. And you look at it and you're going, okay, you look at the safeties and, you know, you've got Jordan Fuller, you've got Terrell Burgess, you've got Taylor Rapp, you've got Nick Scott. Then you look at the more veteran cornerbacks, you've got Jalen Ramsey, you've got Troy Hill, then you've got guys who aren't really veterans, but David Long, Robert Rochelle, they've been around a little bit. And then you've got these younger guys who are showing out, Jacoby Durant, Darian Kendrick. I mean, what, again, special teams, again, so important to all of this, but how many opportunities are going to be there? And I didn't even mention a couple of the younger safeties who played yesterday too, but again, assuming there's full health here, I mean, what are these guys looking at? How much of a competition is there at those positions?
Well, so far, I think it's good that we've seen Jacoby, Darion, Robert Rochelle, and Rush East all on special teams. Like, we've seen them working in one phase or the other, whether it's protection or blocking. Like, and Robert Rochelle, I think, is one of the better, just me watching what he did in camp and as they're working on downing punts and gunner drills. Like, to me, he's one of the more intriguing gunners that they possibly could, that they have, right? That's healthy right now. He's got really long arms. He's got great awareness. He made that great play despite breaking his ribs in the process last year to down a punt like inside the four last season, and then had to, you know, miss a lot of the rest of the season because he broke his ribs while doing it. And so I think, like, when you're talking about special teams specifically, not only does that help maybe justify keeping more of this position group, because you're missing a couple of inside linebackers who would otherwise play special teams for you. Like, Ernest and Bobby are not going to play special teams, as they should not. It's possible that all three of their starting safeties, which I consider them as having three starting safeties because of the caliber of they are and some of the interesting things that they could maybe do with Nick Scott, Jordan Fuller, and Taylor Rapp this year. And, you know, Nick Scott has always played special teams, but I don't think that maybe he's doing that in as high of a volume. So you're subtracting there and adding elsewhere. So it's all, like I said, it's all roster math is all. You could go down a rabbit hole with it.
Yeah.
But I will say for sure, to me, it seems like the Rams are super comfortable with their veterans at the position. It doesn't mean that a young player like a Darion Kendrick or Jacoby Durant, it doesn't mean that they're not at some point sort of lapping some of the older guys late in the season or injuries, what have you. They say it all the time, these DBs, they say we needed every single guy last year, and they did. And so I think that, and then plus, you know, Eric Weddle off the street, right? Or off his couch and or off the pickup basketball court. And so, you know, I think that they feel really good about the level of depth that they have, which is interesting because it was one of the more questioned positions coming into 2022. And I think that that's where you make sort of allowances elsewhere, because you also are thinking you need certain guys in your system and on the roster next year. You've got several contracts coming up in both corner and safety, right? And these are positions outside of Jalen Ramsey that they have not heavily invested in the past financially. So you're looking at, okay, it's not just I need this guy as depth because I know he could step in and play in a pinch this season. I also need him in our system and in the language for next year.
Right.
And so I think that's what you're sort of looking at. And it's interesting because the way that I see the starters right now, as of today, which is August 15th, 2022, the starting corners I see as obviously Jalen Ramsey, as of now, David Long, as of now, Troy Hill. And I think Robert Rochelle sort of is on the line there just because he does have the experience and he's got so much potential and he really has battled. They have isolated him a lot on the outside and he's really battled. But I also think that really coming in hot is Darion Kendrick in a similar sort of outside corner role. And you need two of them, right? Because Jalen's still going to play inside. And, you know, at some point, maybe even shift to safety later, you know, later on in his career. And so you need guys who can command those outer posts and those overhang spots at corner, right? So that's fine. If there's competition at that outside CB spot, that's perfectly fine if you're the Rams. And then at safety, I see, and then, you know, obviously, Kobe Durant, absolutely they want to keep long term, and so, you know, not to discount him, Dan Isom did some nice things. They'll want to probably keep him on their practice squad and try to stash him a bit. But in terms of the starters, that's who I'm seeing right now this year. In terms of starters for safeties, who I'm seeing right now, you know, if they're going to start in a two high, I'm looking at Jordan Fuller and Nick Scott. Jordan Fuller is still working back to full health, as I keep saying over and over and over and over again, because I saw some headlines that were like, whoa, why isn't Jordan Fuller listed as a starting safety? And I'm like, okay, well, he is a starting safety. And I've seen that every single day at training camp. Right. But he's also working back from an injury, which we've said many, many times. And then you have Taylor Rapp, who I also consider a starting caliber safety in some of the sub packages if they explore certain things. Like, of course, you're going to see that. And then, you know, Terrell Burgess is there for. But I think Russ Yeast has a ton of potential and also can contribute in a variety of ways. So you kind of want to keep him around too. And I don't know if you can, stash a Russ Yeast. There are so many teams playing now the two high shell that Russ not only came out of, but also seems very aware of and very seems to be fitting in fine. And, you know, other teams, the Brandon Staley's, you know, the Kevin O'Connell's, like they're kind of side-eyeing who the Rams have on their rosters right now, right? Mm-hmm. And the Jiro Evero's, like they're kind of side-eyeing, like, okay, who might they got a lot of these guys, who might they cut? And like, we need this specific language in this system. So that's a first, you know, when you're doing the roster math, all of this is gets so complicated, but yeah, that's how I kind of handicap the starting DBs. And that's kind of what I look at in terms of that roster math that we love so much, Rich.
Yeah, I love that position too. That's the one I keep an eye on. Like I like the potential there. I like the mix that they have and just very curious to see. And great point, Jordan, too, is that, you know, this roster math that you're talking about is not always about this year. I mean, I'm Captain Obvious here saying this, but you don't have a farm team. You don't have the ability to send guys down and develop them and, oh, we'll call them up next year. And no. I mean, they have to be part of your calculus right now. If you're planning on keeping them around, if you see them as part of your future. And obviously you've seen that in past years with some young guys who do end up then developing into starters.
And I just wanted to point out, because I'm getting ahead of the narrative here. I'm getting ahead of the story, or not the story, but I'm getting ahead of the jokes here. I know that I cannot say Rush East's name correctly. Like I know that I can't, I hear it. My mouth doesn't move that way. Like unless I really tried. Russ Yeast. But when I'm talking in my normal cadence, it comes out as Russ Yeast and I hear it. Like, please know that I hear it. And it's like I'm watching a train wreck. I can't do anything about it. So I'm trying, but I cannot do anything about it. So
you're going to give me a complex. I'm going to start saying Russ Yeast. It's hard to.
It's a great name. Yeah, it's a fantastic name. And and trust me, I mean no disrespect at all. I hear myself stumbling over it,
right?
Because like I've always had that issue where it's kind of like a bit of a slur, like a sober slur, a sober slurring, especially with consonants that I kind of get into sometimes.
That's fascinating. Well, we're gonna have to do.
Is
a
it?
List
of, is yes, it? Yes. Should we edit this part?
No, not at all.
This is boring.
This is going to be the highlight of the podcast here. We're gonna come up with a list of names and have Jordan try to say them.
Oh god. they're gonna be like, what's really in her hydro flask? What's going
on? Well, Jordan, before we go, we need to stay on brand and talk about special teams. Well, we have a little bit. We've talked about how all of these guys contribute on special teams. But the one thing that we can look at, I don't know, is this even so much of a competition anymore? I mean, we saw Cameron Dicker handling pretty much everything, I think, on Saturday. But is this, are we really down to Matt Gay and Riley Dixon? I mean, is there a whole lot that's going to change that between now and week one?
Something else I can't say, ABTAST, always be talking about special teams. I say abtashed. Yeah. Abtashed. Abtashed. Yeah, I'm so sorry. That's.
We'll put that on the list.
You've never seen me and, who is it, Sean Connery in the same room at the same time. I think, honestly, if I were going to say they play games tomorrow, I think it's Matt Gay and Riley Dixon. You saw Riley Dixon coming in on holds, and to me that was really telling. He's the one throwing fades to Kira Bishop in the end zone. Like, he's got the quarterback. Like, that tells me a little bit of something. It's not that Cameron Dicker, to me, he is super intriguing, super talented, really, really valuable. I think that's something that if the Rams can keep him on their practice squad, they will, and they absolutely should. I thought he handled kickoffs well. I thought he punted well, in a lot of those sort of safe situations. Like, I think he just – the versatility there is great, and I think that they really like that about him. And he also offers them such a great thing in practice every day, because he can be a live leg in a variety of different ways, and you need to – when you have veteran specialists in other phases – You have to consider that. You have to consider, okay, how many reps can we really have this person do? And there's no substitute for a live leg in practice if you're working on your coverage unit. So I think if they can keep Riley Dixon around, especially on the practice squad, like, not only are you looking at someone who can come in an emergency situation, and you're hopefully not having that, but we've seen it, some of the COVID stuff that they dealt with and all of that, you are looking at someone who could come in a pinch and play for you, but you are also looking at so much more efficient work for your coverage units when you're not working off a jugs machine. If there's one thing I've learned over the last 3 years,
yes,
it's how many different types of punts there are and how many different types of things you need to do to execute those punts if you're the coverage unit. And then also on the other side, the return unit against a live leg is so much more valuable than the jugs machine. And I think that is a really, really great thing in having Cameron Dicker there. Riley Dixon, though, in my mind, this is less of a competition than maybe they made it out to be. The snap share was pretty blatant from the jump. At the same time, everyone's spot has to be earned this time of year, other than, if you're Aaron Donald, Matthew Stafford, Jalen Ramsey, Cooper Kupp,
or
Allen Robinson, or any number of players.
Or Jordan Rodrigue. Your spot is also secure. So.
God, I hope so.
Yeah, no question about it. I've heard. Don't worry. Lots of fun, Jordan. Rams' first preseason game in the books. Looking ahead now to Friday night against the Houston Texans there at SoFi Stadium. Last opportunity. Only 3 preseason games. So if anybody wants to go out and check it out before the season opener, now's your chance to go see the exciting Houston Texans and your Los Angeles Rams.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Jordan, we've had a lot of fun, but we want to transition here because we have a very, very interesting guest and a topic that I think is compelling not only to Rams fans, but to football fans around the country, and a great book that we're going to take a look at. So do you want to introduce our special guest?
Yeah. So super excited, Rich. Without further ado, here's Dan Taylor. We have a treat for 11 Personnel listeners this morning. Author Dan Taylor joins us on the show. So Dan wrote Walking Alone, The Untold Journey of Football Pioneer Kenny Washington, a person who, of course, all Rams fans should know about as the first Black football player to sign a contract in the NFL, which he did so in 1946. Dan, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be with you guys. Thanks.
We are stoked to have you. You wrote this story in such rich detail, and it is a story that I think needs to be broadly known, not through the arc, not just through the arc of football's history, but through the arc of American history. So as you're sort of getting inspired to that, this is the subject, right? This is the thing that you are going to spend probably every waking second writing about, thinking about over the course of a couple of years. What inspired you to write Kenny Washington's story? Because you didn't just write his general biography. Like, this, I want people to know, like, this is his story in such deep detail, and stunningly, so many still don't know about.
Well, a great friend of mine is a UCLA guy, and we were having a conversation one day about Jackie Robinson. And he was telling me that when he was at UCLA in the 60s, that there were a couple of professors there who were there on campus in 39 when Kenny Washington and Jackie Robinson were in the same backfield of the UCLA football team. And these professors insisted that, as great as Jackie Robinson was, football and baseball, that Kenny Washington was far better. And my friend later in his first coaching job had a colleague who had been a teammate on that 39 UCLA team. And he said the same thing. And, you know, having gone to UCLA games, I knew Kenny's number was retired, which meant he was probably a pretty good football player. And that he'd been with the Rams, and that he was the first African-American in the NFL, which was a little confusing to me because I certainly heard the stories of Fritz Pollard and Paul Robeson, who played many years earlier. And so when we had this conversation, it just really sparked my curiosity. And when I rolled up my sleeves and started doing some research into Kenny Washington to learn more about him, I was just constantly blown away. It was just, you know, adjective after adjective after adjective, you know, reading articles or talking to various people who had a connection to him. And I was really floored in one of my first conversations with the editor I worked with at Roman and Littlefield. And she said, "Are you telling me this story's never been told?" And I said, "I'm in disbelief about that myself. This is just maybe the greatest football player of all time, according to Hall of Famers who saw him." And he had such a remarkable impact in so many areas. You know, could have been right there with Jackie Robinson as first African-American in baseball. Could have been an outstanding heavyweight boxer, was a star of movies. Just an amazing life. And I'm just stunned that the story had not been told before.
Why do you think that is, Dan? Because, I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles. I've lived my entire life here. And I heard the name Kenny Washington, but not in any depth, certainly not in any depth that you heard Jackie Robinson and heard the legends. Why do you think that is? Why did that story go untold for so long, given that he was such a tremendous athlete and such a big part of history?
I'm really puzzled by that myself, Rich, because I do think, in one hand, Jackie Robinson has really overshadowed him. And I understand that, and I have no criticism of that. But I do think that Kenny really deserved to be held up as well. I think part of it, too, is the timing. When Jackie Robinson signed in October 45 with the Dodger organization, you know, baseball was far and away the national pastime. And almost every newspaper in the country, you know, ran stories with huge headlines about Jackie signing. At the time that Kenny signed with the Rams, football was maybe sixth, seventh on the interest list in America. And it was really no big deal. You saw stories in most of the papers that were just nothing more than a sentence or two or a single line in a sports column, sports notes column. So, you know, I think those were big, big factors. And also, you know, a lot was made of Kenny being the Jackie Robinson of the NFL. And in reality, you know, I've tried to really be as accurate as I can on this, that he reintegrated the NFL. Right. We went through a 12, 13-year period where they had this unwritten policy, but that there were men like Fritz Pollard and Joe Lillard and others. And I can see where, you know, people have asked, well, why doesn't the NFL treat Kenny like baseball does Jackie? And I think it's a difficult question to answer, but my thought is, not having asked it of the NFL directly, but you disrespect the guys that were there before him by focusing the spotlight on Kenny. And I think that's probably another factor as well.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's, as we look back to, and you obviously, in researching this book, you were immersed in the the time period in terms of the coverage at the time, not just about Kenny or the lack thereof, but also just about the sports landscape in general at that time. And as we continue to sort of reflect and study what the media landscape is and how it, what it's turned into, I do think that an ongoing conversation is how we can frame and how media can frame the stories of a diverse range of people and players that, frankly and clearly, there was no bandwidth or awareness or effort for outside of people who were outliers, right? And there was only the space for, you know, okay, one person who's an outlier, okay, we're going to cover them. And that's such a problematic part, I think, of our landscape as media, but also, you know, the American landscape in general, where, okay, more than one person who is of a diverse background can exist as an outlier at the same time, right? And I think that that's such a problematic part, obviously. And you, I'm sure, as you're going through all of these old newspapers, I would imagine, and radio broadcasts and all of these things, I'm sure you that struck you as well. And so I do want to talk to you about your research process, because this book, I do also want to reiterate, I know I've said it a couple of times, but this book is so detailed. And I think you really captured, like, you could tell, you, as I'm reading this as a journalist, I'm thinking to myself, my God, this man sorted through hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words of copy.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It's fascinating to see how it was covered. You know, there was no athletic back then. There was no sports
shame.
Center back then.
What a shame.
They really lost. And it's kind of reflective in the Heisman Trophy voting, mm-hmm. because Kenny carries the West Coast, but that's it. And the rest of the country really didn't know a lot about him. Many of UCLA's games were played at night. And probably the most celebrated sports writer of that day was Grantland Rice. And Grantland Rice was the only one of 13 All-America selectors not to choose Kenny for any of his first, second, or third team squads. It was the coverage back then in Los Angeles, very open-minded, somewhat progressive. He was the most popular athlete in the city. And he got, from high school on, got just amazing coverage. And, you know, Alice Marble wins Wimbledon in 1939, comes home to Los Angeles, and finishes second in the Athlete of the Year voting to Kenny Washington. You know, where else in the country would that happen? You know, that's one of the things I tried to research, was what other cities was an African-American the most popular athlete, you know, in 1939, 40, 41? You know, maybe Joe Louis in Detroit. That's hard to say, but there was no denying Kenny Washington was the most popular athlete in Southern California. But around the country, yeah, different pockets of the country, he was ignored, or just, you know, a little notice. It was very fascinating to see.
How do you think Kenny processed all of that, Dan? I mean, I understand it's a product of the times, and you know, looking back, we can see terrible injustice. But at the time, how does he process that, being the best player in college football and really not having a path to continue that at the highest level?
You know, Rich, that's a question that I carried throughout this whole process and really never got an answer to. And it was one of the tough parts of trying to research this book. You know, his daughter was very upfront that she came into the family well after Kenny's career, and to her, he was dad. And she told me a story, and I hope I'm remembering it accurately, that I think she was in middle school and she came home from school one day and Willie Mays is sitting at the kitchen table talking to her dad. And she said, that's kind of when the light bulb went off. Gosh, my dad must have been somebody, you know. Yeah. Kenny's son passed away a number of years ago. His grandson shared that they knew a bit, but not a lot. So it was very difficult. And that's one of the things, you know, how was he raised? What did his grandmother instill in him? Or his uncle, Rocky? You know, his parents were really out of the home. He didn't have much of a relationship with all his father, who was pretty much an absent father. You know, he was born Lincoln Heights at that time, was an immigrant neighborhood. His neighbors were all immigrants from Italy. When he got to UCLA, Woody Strode laughed that one of the amazing things about him wasn't his athletic ability, but they spoke with a bit of an Italian accent. So that's what I really wanted to learn. His daughter shared an interesting story about, I asked about his relationship with Jackie Robinson. Hmm. And she said they were friends. And in really digging deeper and talking to Babe Horrell's daughters, the 39 UCLA head coach. You know, Kenny was really a mentor to Jackie Robinson. Jackie had a real volatile temper, and he was not well liked initially by his teammates at UCLA. And Kenny would take him on long walks and try to really make him see big picture and calm him and you know, teach him about fighting his battles, you know, when they're warranted. But I wanted to know where that came from. And sadly, I just could never really get that answer. I thought that was a really important thing to be able to share was, you know, how Kenny was raised and learned these lessons. Because there's no denying from everything I read and everybody I talked to, he was a high character individual. But Rich, that was a real frustration trying to peg that, you know, to particular life lessons or the influence of someone in his young life.
And sorry, just to finish, for people who don't know, he died very young too. Mm-hmm. So probably also a complication in putting all of this together, right? I mean, he died at 52.
Exactly. He suffered a very rare and incurable heart-lung disease, spent most of the last 2 years of his life in hospitals. But in 1971, he passed at the age of 52. That's correct.
I guess too, in hearing you talk about just wanting to know more and sometimes hitting that wall of sometimes the information just didn't exist to find or hadn't been preserved. So for you, I would imagine that reiterated your passion to making sure that this remarkable man was preserved and is preserved in history in a way that shines more of a light, even though you yourself are still, I think, in search of details. You know, this book is so comprehensive. It's like it. You really felt how important it was that this person is preserved for you. And so I wonder, did that sort of keep you going sometimes when things were frustrating in terms of that research process?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was a very, you know, every step of the way, it just, you know, the importance of it grew. Mm-hmm. You know, to the earlier question, another thing that was very challenging and very frustrating and that I never got answered. You know, UCLA in 1939 had 5 African-Americans on their team. All were pretty much recruited under Bill Spalding's watch as the head coach. He stepped down after the 38th season. But what was it about Bill Spalding when there were only 12 schools in America that had integrated football teams at that time? And that was a question I tried to get answered. You know, what was his background? What were his thoughts? Why is it that he really had no issue with having African-American players on his team, and across town, USC did. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing. I tried reaching out to family members. It drove me crazy to find out that his son actually for many, many years didn't live too far from me and has since passed away. Tried to reach a grandson and didn't really have any luck connecting. And that was another big question that was very frustrating. I mean, Bill Ackerman oversaw the athletic department at that time. And I did find an article that mentioned that, you know, when he would try to make the travel accommodations and if he found any hotel that had any issue with UCLA having African-American players, Bill Ackerman's line was always, we're all God's children. Mm-hmm. And so that told me a little bit about Ackerman, but I could never really pin down Bill Spalding. And those were things that were really challenging. And it's your thought about your question also about media coverage. What was stunning was the terms that the media used about Washington and Robinson and Woody Strode and the others. I mean, it was horrific to read this stuff. And it was very common back then. You know, I'm working on another book as well. And I've found that back east as well with regard to Italian Americans. It was just stunning, the terminology that was used at that time.
Dan, you talked about this being the reintegration, so to speak, with Kenny. Can you? I know this is such a huge part of it. I'm asking you to sum it up in a couple of minutes here. But the motivations in 1946 around that time, motivation for a team like the Rams to make that move when they did, why other teams did and didn't, why was that the right moment for Kenny? Why was that the right moment for the Rams? And I'm assuming the motives in these cases are not always entirely pure for the teams.
Well, a lot has been said about when the Rams general manager Chili Walsh initially came into town after they had made their announcement that they were leaving Cleveland for Los Angeles. he went before the Coliseum Commission to secure a lease. And at that time, USC and UCLA had exclusivity. In part of their lease, it said no professional football could be played in the Coliseum. So there were behind-the-scenes negotiations with them to allow the Rams to come in and use the Coliseum. But when Chilia Walsh went before the Coliseum Commission, there were three African-American newspapers in the city at that time, and they appointed Hallie Harding of the Sentinel to be their spokesperson. And he stood up at the meeting and gave a very impassioned speech. And in a nutshell said, the Coliseum was built with taxpayer money. African-Americans in the community were among those taxpayers. And a lease should not be granted to an organization, a team that will not sign African-American players. And Chilia Walsh took offense. It became a little bit contentious, but Walsh declared, we will sign Kenny Washington. Now, I've also uncovered some information that indicated that the Rams also saw Washington as a box office draw. They knew how popular he was. And you know, the Hollywood Bears were selling out that 22,000-seat Gilmore Stadium week in, week out because of Kenny Washington. And so they saw the box office and potential there and the importance. And Chilia Walsh had hired a local sports writer to be their PR director. And he had directed him to get with Kenny as soon as possible and get a commitment from him that he would sign with the Rams. So I don't want to understate Hallie Harding's importance of what Hallie Harding did. That was huge. Mm-hmm. But so I think there were two reasons there. I think, you know, the Rams were answering the community, but the Rams also saw the box office potential in having Kenny Washington. And I've often thought, because the All-America Football Conference started at that same time. They launched in 46, and Los Angeles had a team, the Dons, which was owned by the actor Don Ameche, and others, Bob Hope and whatnot, were investors as well. And I've often thought, how different could things have been? How different mm-hmm. could the professional football landscape have been if they were the aggressors who went after Kenny Washington rather than the Rams?
I want to get to your favorite details without giving away too many spoilers of the book. I know you have many, but first I do want to ask too, because you're writing this, and you know, the Rams have sort of dug in themselves into a little bit more of this history in their own, you know, out of their own sort of organizational perspective. And so I'm kind of wondering too, but overall, the NFL as a whole, have you seen, I don't even want to say enough, because we know it's not enough at this time, but what has his legacy, how is it sort of framed now in your perspective, in the league as a whole, not just, you know, the Hall of Fame issue, but also, you know, just in terms of the league recognizing some of its trailblazers?
Well, you know, I think that over the last year, more has been done to put a spotlight both on Kenny, Woody Strode, and the guys in Cleveland who integrated the AAFC at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think more should be done. I've heard from a lot of people who have questioned whether Rams haven't done more. You know, a number of people have said, why haven't they retired his number? I think it's easy to look at his productivity with the Rams and say, well, he's not Hall of Fame worthy. Three seasons, only one was good. You know, he had problems with the knee his first year. It's easy to look at that. And also to look at, you know, the African-Americans who played before him and say, well, he really wasn't the guy. He wasn't the Jackie Robinson. But I think in the big picture, the things he went through, it was as much as if he was. But also I think we really lose sight of what he did with the Hollywood Bears that laid the foundation for the NFL to have success in California. Pro football had struggled to get any kind of a foothold in California at all for years. And when the Pacific Coast Professional Football League started in 1940 and Kenny became the sensation in that league, that really laid the foundation for the NFL to have success. You know, the Rams didn't just look at Los Angeles. They put a deposit down also on the Cotton Bowl in Dallas if they couldn't get a deal in L.A. And, you know, 20-30% of their attendance at many of their games in 46 was African-American fans. Mm-hmm. That was very similar to the Hollywood Bears crowds, Gilmore Stadium. And whenever the Bears went on the road, be it San Diego or Phoenix, the biggest crowds that were drawn around the league were when Kenny Washington came to town. So I think we haven't looked enough at his importance in laying that foundation for professional football to be the first major league sport on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. So I know this is hard too, But
no, you just keep tossing them.
I know. I know this is maybe an impossible question to answer, but your favorite details in this book, and there's so many.
The one thing, you know, I've read, I love baseball. Mm-hmm. Forgive me. But here's we're talking
we'll
football.
We'll allow it.
Hey, I'm a Rams fan. I've had a lot of friends play for the club. But I've read a lot about Jackie Robinson. And I've read, there have been so many stories and books written about the other guys that were considered. I've never once seen that Kenny Washington was in the mix. And that amazed me that Jackie Robinson was lobbying Branch Rickey, because Rickey had said he was going to sign two African-Americans. And Jackie was lobbying Rickey to make Kenny the second. And Wendell Smith, the Hall of Fame sports editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, who was a confidant of Rickey's, sent a letter to Branch Rickey. I've seen the letter. And in it, he states, you know, he reminds him that he was going to sign a second black player. Mm-hmm. And he points out that it should be Kenny, because you will find Kenny is better than Jackie Robinson. I mean, I knew of Kenny as the football guy. I had no idea about Kenny as the baseball guy. And that amazed, absolutely amazed me.
Wow. Yeah. I encourage everybody to go. There are so many more details like this one that, again, are a fascinating part of history, but also an important one. And Dan, thank you so much for being on with us today. Thank you for sharing more about this, not just your process, but about Kenny and about this book. Really, really appreciate you taking the time.
No, this is a treat. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan. Again, Walking Alone, The Untold Journey of Football Pioneer Kenny Washington. Brand new book, only been out for just about a month. So make sure you go to any and all of your book suppliers to pick this up today from Dan Taylor. So thank you very much, Dan, for a very interesting chat and an excellent book.
Thank you very much.
Well, Jordan, that was very cool. Again, like I said, I mean, I grew up in Los Angeles and frankly, a little bit embarrassed that I don't know as much about Kenny Washington as I should. So really enjoyed talking to Dan there, and really do encourage everybody to go out and pick up that book. So great episode today. I mean, lots of insights, some history lessons.
We're
showing our range, Jordan, as we do from time to time. So it's great to be back in the groove here. Great to be watching some football again. And of course, Jordan is all over it every day on Twitter at Jordan Rodrigue. And of course, you need to subscribe to The Athletic to follow her outstanding coverage. It's going to be real interesting here for the rest of the preseason, and of course, leading up to that game against the Buffalo Bills. So thank you, of course, to all of our subscribers. And if you haven't subscribed yet, now is the time. And the way that you do that, very easy, very simple, will only take a minute or two. Go to theathletic.com/11personnel. You'll get all of Jordan's coverage for the foreseeable future. And you will get her favorite thing in the entire world, which is what?
A great discount. You guys, all year round, whether or not we are running a special at theathletic.com, which we are currently doing, $1 per month for new subscribers, another great discount. But all year round, through the exciting camp days of August to the dog days of November and December, you can get a great discount, my favorite thing in the world, at The Athletic if you subscribe through the 11 Personnel podcast. Once again, my favorite thing in the world, every time you subscribe to The Athletic through the 11 Personnel podcast. You guys, this was a fun episode to do. The preseason is rolling. Holy cow. You know, Rams versus Texans. What a time to be alive. We will be reporting back after that next week. And in the meantime, you guys, I hope you're taking care of yourselves. I hope you're taking care of each other. We'll see you next time.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.